Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN Radio. The name of this book is called The Puppy Parents Handbook, Raising a Well-Trained Puppy in the 21st Century. Drayton Michaels is the author, but Drayton has also been passionate and involved with the entire pit bull breed-specific issue, and we'll get into that too. But first, let's talk about puppies. I don't think you could say that word, Drayton, without putting a smile on someone's face. I think it's impossible.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're not happy around puppies, you should definitely get some counseling.
I guess the number one question is, should I get a puppy? And even though your book is about puppies, you clearly state that puppies aren't for everyone. We sometimes forget what it was like to have a puppy. They're a lot of work. So if you're 112 years old, it might not be the dog for you.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. And that's why I started the book with that question, which is, should you get a puppy? Because there's a lot of legwork. The benefit is you get to put your imprint on the dog. But, you know, if you've got small children or busy lifestyle, or as you mentioned, if you're a little bit older, and hey, I'm a little bit older, I'm 59, so I totally understand how things progress when we get older. You may want to reconsider it just because it's very challenging. I do maybe 5 classes a month, puppy classes, that is. And, you know, I will get some older folks with puppies and they find it challenging, mainly because they forgot what it was like 15 years prior when they got their last puppy. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't get puppies by any means, but just really think about it, regardless of where you are in your life, because that first year in particular, there is a lot of extra work.
And the name of your book is, in fact, The Puppy Parents Handbook, not The Old Dog Handbook. Having said that, if you're an older person, I'm a proponent of going to an animal shelter, talking with the adoption counselor to make sure it's a good fit, but actually adopting a senior dog for a senior. What do you think?
I think that's a fabulous idea. You know, a lot of the older dogs who get relinquished to shelters are really having a hard time because they're, in fact, older dogs and they've probably had a longer history in a home dynamic. And, you know, if you're up there in age and maybe you're a little less physically adept than you used to be, why not go get a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old dog?
Yeah.
Sure, you're not going to have as much time with that dog, but you're going to be doing a great thing for that dog, and you'll be able to have a dog, and it probably won't be as much of a challenge.
Now, you write about something that's somewhat controversial. I don't think it should be, and I agree with what you say about it, and that is where you get the dog in the first place. And while I am a supporter, proponent of rescues, legitimate rescues, and animal shelters, of course, if I want a purebred or a pedigree Irish wolfhound, I'm not likely necessarily to find one, although there is a rescue for every breed, but that closest one may be 10 states away. It might not be practical to do, or maybe it's a female only, and I want a male dog because I've always had male dogs, or whatever the case might be. Or I want a skipper key. Well, good luck finding one of those in rescue. There is a rescue for skipper keys, but again, might be 8 states away from you, the only available dogs. You're right, there's nothing wrong, assuming you go to a reputable breeder, of getting a purebred dog. And I do agree with you. Why are you supportive of the idea for people who want it?
Well, I think any dog that's in a loving home, that's dedicated and is going to supply a great life for a dog, is a rescued dog. As I mentioned in the book, there's plenty of dogs who cost thousands of dollars, and for one reason or another, they're languishing in a shelter right now. And there's plenty of dogs who, you know, were rescued or dogs off the street that people found, and they're living a great life, because the common denominator for a good life for a dog is always the human. And unfortunately, you know, people give up on their dogs way too easy sometimes. And I understand that, you know, people are going to have life happen to them. I'm the person who would live on the streets or in my car with my dog. I would never give my dog up, no matter what. But, you know, there are people who, for whatever reason, are going to relinquish their dog to a shelter. And it's great that shelters are there. But you're absolutely right. And I'm glad you brought that up. You know, if you want a particular kind of dog, you might be able to find a rescue that specializes in that dog, but there may be some particulars that aren't really too conducive of going to that rescue. And again, if you buy a dog from a breeder and they're a reputable breeder, then I don't judge you. I'm just glad that the dog found its way into a loving home that's going to be dedicated and help that dog live a great life.
All right. So let's say I'm going to get a puppy. The first thing I have to do, you say, is puppy-proof my home. What does that mean?
Well, it means to go around your house and make sure that things like extension cords or, you know, certain kinds of rugs, you know, make sure your door to your bathroom is shut, the kids' toys are picked up. And, you know, to that end, have a conversation with everybody in the house and explain to them that puppies are going to investigate the world with their mouth, and it only takes 4 finger snaps of a human for a dog to chew through an electrical cord and start your house on fire. The puppy dies. Now, I know that's morbid, but it's a heck of a motivator. And, you know, to a lesser extent, you know, a dog gets a hold of an ink pen or something like that, and now you're at the vet and you're spending, you know, thousands of dollars to help the dog. So, you know, most of the time it can be avoided if you have a puppy pen that's completely dog proofed and the dog's crate's in there, and that's kind of where the puppy hangs out. And then, as I say in the book, if your puppy has access to the house, you got to be like an NBA referee and you got to be on that puppy, because you don't want to have house training issues, and you also don't want to have the dog chewing on illegal stuff.
Yeah. So there's a rule pretty much that as a puppy, as a young puppy, they will do one of several things. They will sleep, they will eat, they will play, and they will go to the bathroom. And if the dog hasn't gone to the bathroom, that's always what comes next. So if the dog wakes up from sleeping, the dog is playing. If you're successful, then take your dog to the bathroom after any of those things happen. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. The first thing you do with the puppy before you give them freedom in your home is you get them outside to relieve themselves. House training isn't that difficult. I have an approach to it, which involves, number one, write out your dog's potty schedule. So from the first potty outing all the way to the last one, and you write it out for 7 days, that's going to give you a good bit of data to see, oh, geez, every day at this time, my dog is doing this. You also include when you feed your dog. Second thing is if you limit water. So that means first thing in the morning, all the water the puppy wants, let them drink till their heart's content. But when you come back in, depending on the size of the dog, and, you know, I go through that with my clients, but generally as a rule, maybe like, you know, 8 to 12 good sips of water, and you pick the water up, because you're going to bring the puppy out for a potty break probably in 2 hours anyway. And then also don't scold your puppy or startle them or pick them up while they're going to the bathroom in the house, because what that will do is cause a negative association to you in the context of going to the bathroom. And plenty of clients of mine have said, you know, my puppy goes outside, I have them on leash, I'm standing next to them, but they won't go. As soon as I bring them in the house, they go to the bathroom. Well, dogs innately know when they're going to the bathroom that they're vulnerable. So if you have the association of clapping in the dog's face or, you know, rushing them outside, they're going to be afraid of you while they're going to the bathroom.
So what we want to and do is to encourage the dogs to go where we want them to go. So how do we do that? And I want to talk more about house training, because, you know, you said it's a simple thing and we're talking about it for 5 minutes already, right? So it is sometimes a reason why people actually give up the dog, because they are so difficult to house train. But you're right. There are ways around that. There are tips and tricks. We'll offer some of those from Drayton Michaels when we come back on WGN. Drayton Michaels is the author of The Puppy Parents Handbook, Raising a Well-Trained Puppy in the 21st Century. We're in the 21st century? Gosh, that's kind of depressing to think about, or I'm not sure. Are we in the 21st century? Really?
Oh, we certainly are.
Who knew that? I didn't know that. All right, but I do know about house training. We're talking about that. I stopped you in midstream only because we had a break for some commercials, but I want to talk about what to do when your dog does go where you want your dog to go, and how we encourage that to happen to begin with, Drayton.
Sure. Well, you want your puppy to go outside, obviously. But one of the things that I remind people of is don't praise or treat your puppy while they're actually going. You want to wait till they're completely done and they're actually walking away from the pile. Because if you say, yay, good girl, in the middle of it, they're probably going to cut the stream, especially if you've been issuing a treat at the end of it. And if they cut the stream, you're going to think, oh, they're done. And then they go in the house and they finish. You know, one of the things that we talk about in the book is to feed your puppy in every room in the house except the bathroom, because that's going to bolster cleanliness instinct. Dogs actually have a natural cleanliness instinct. In the wild, dogs will go to the bathroom in one area and sleep and eat in the other. So what you want to do is you want to teach your puppy to sleep and eat all over the house, because then that's going to bolster their cleanliness instinct. And again, as I said in the last segment, don't scold or startle your puppy if they're going in the house. Just hold them in place so they don't step in it, and then contain them safely and clean it up.
What about the idea, though, that you get home and the dog has gone potty, or you've walked into the other room and the dog has done the same thing? Is that the dog's fault, or is that maybe your fault?
Well, you know, it always comes down to the human. We have bigger brains and we have thumbs, so we have to take responsibility. Look, it's a biological event, right? And biology is not always exact. And dogs are going to grow their liver, their kidney, their spleen, all the biological functions that, you know, result in a dog relieving itself. All that's going to grow differently for different dogs. I've had puppies who were house trained in 2 weeks. I've had some dogs take 6 months. At the end of the day, if you follow the steps in the puppy parent's handbook, though, you'll have success sooner rather than later. And one of the big things is write out that schedule for 7 days. That data is going to change a little bit as the puppy gets stronger. Limit your water the way we discussed, where you give the dog all the water they want every couple of hours, starting with the first outing of the morning, and then just count your sips, anywhere from 8 to 12 good sips. Feed your dog and all over the house. You know, you can put down a blanket or a towel. You can use a food bowl, a work to eat toy. You can just walk around and train your dog with treats. And then when you are outside with your puppy, one of the things we talk about in the book is counter conditioning, where you use the word yes, like a marker, like a clicker, every time there's an environmental event where your dog orients to it. Because the big reason why puppies and also adult dogs don't go to the bathroom outside is they're stressed. So if you reduce the dog's stress and you create an environment in your home where they think, you know, geez, I sleep and eat all over this house, so this whole house is a place that I should not go to the bathroom in, you're going to have success much quicker.
That's a very good point. And I wanted to, in fact, you brought this up, say, yes, what are you referring to when you do this? And should you begin training like instantly when you get your puppy? So if your puppy does something right, whatever it might be, I think the most important is the puppy knows his or her name, and you call the dog and the dog comes to you. Hey, Weasel. Who calls their dog Weasel? But Weasel. How did I come up with that? And the dog comes, that poor dog named Weasel, that's crazy. And the dog comes, you say, yes, and reward your dog with a treat as well. Is that kind of what you're trying to say, apart from the Weasel part?
I've heard worse names. There's two different things that you're talking about. Name recognition is not recall. And I often remind people that name recognition just means your dog checks in with you. They just look at you. So you want to get that going real easy. The yes word we use as a marker, and a marker is officially known as a stimulus bridge, and it bridges the gap between the behavior and the food reward. So you always pair your marker, whether it's a clicker or the word yes, you always pair that with a food reward. So if I ask for my dog's name and I say Mojo, and he looks at me, yes, I give him a treat. And then that's going to reinforce his name. As far as your dog coming to you, that would be recall or hand targeting. You can use touch, having your dog target your palm to come over to you. But what I always tell people about their dog's name is never use it in any way that's stressful or negative, because it's probably going to be the first word out of your mouth. And if they don't have a good association to their name, all the cues after it aren't going to be so successful.
That's a very important point. What about keeping your dog in jail? Well, that's not the way I look at it. And that's not the way you describe it in your book. But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, timeouts are really effective, and they're only for 10 seconds, and you want to have your criteria exact. So here's what I time puppies out for. If it's a large breed or medium breed dog, I might give them a little bit of reprieve in, you know, the first couple of days, But I'm going to first, you know, let them know right away, like, if you're jumping all over me, I'm going to time you out real quick. It doesn't have to be in a scary way, and it should never be in a scary way. I often equate it to being a referee. It's just matter of fact, too bad. And then we bring the puppy to their crate. If they have a great association to their crate, it's not going to ruin it. That's a big common myth and a concern. It's only 10 seconds. And I'll time the puppy out for really egregious mouthing or biting, such as if they just grab a hold of my shoelaces and just start tugging. I'm going to pop their little mouth off my clothes or my shoes, and I'm going to say, too bad, and put them into a gated area or into their crate for 10 seconds. The other thing is counters, tables. That's definitely always going to be timed out no matter what, because that's, you know, not only is it a matter of safety, because who knows what's going to be on the table or the counter, but it's also a matter of just being sanitary. I love dogs. I kiss them. They can sleep in my bed, but I really don't want their paws on the kitchen table or the kitchen counter, that kind of thing. So timeouts are very effective, and they teach the dog the right flow chart. One of the things I talk about in the book that I've been doing for years is I use the oops, right? I use an oops warning because it's a lot of legwork that you're going to save. For instance, if the dog is looking at my friend and there's a 98% chance the dog's going to jump on my friend, I'll go, oops. If the dog recalibrates, freedom is had. But if the dog continues and jumps, I time the dog out. In time, that oops, that is going to be a warning, and they're going to associate that with the next step in the procedure is a timeout. I had a great story in my past where a woman had a couple of the kids at the kitchen table. She's doing dishes. Her husband lets the puppy in. She just turns around and went, oops, and the puppy went and laid down. She emailed me telling me that I was a genius. I said, no, Pavlov's a genius. I'm just really good at explaining stuff. So, you know, there's, again, the thing that I remind people about dogs are easy. What's difficult are the environments. But the good news is humans control the environment for the most part.
Drayton, oops, we have to pause for commercials. But when we come back, I want to ask you about things that dogs do as puppies that we think are cute, but then they do it as an adult. It's not so cute anymore. We'll talk with Drayton Michaels about that and also about pit bull bans. Sadly, they've come back in places all when we come back on WGN. This is very important. Check out the Petcast. It's back at WGNradio.com. Dr. Renee Schmid talks about dangers over the holidays. Yeah, that's right. Well, the conversation is varied, but it includes, yes, chocolate. You know about chocolate, but you know about something called xylitol. Xylitol is an artificial sweetener or sugar substitute that actually is deadly to dogs or cats. Raisins for dogs, potentially deadly. We talk about a wide variety of topics. Check it out at WGNradio.com. It is the WGN Radio Steve Dale Petcast. Human Animal Bond Association celebrates the human animal bond and is looking for pictures of you with your dog or cat or any pet in particular. Just send those to Steve at stevedale.tv. I'm on their board. I'll make sure the picture might appear on the website or in the Human Animal Bond Association social media. Drayton Michaels is the author of Modern Dog Training, The Puppy Parent's Handbook, Raising a Well-Trained Puppy in the 21st Century. So you're raising that well-trained puppy, and there are some things that you, that's okay, it's so cute. So the dog is nibbling on your fingers, and it looks cute, or the dog is jumping on you, and you say, hey, when I get home, I want a dog to greet me and to say hello. Now that dog is a much bigger dog, and grandma walks into the house, and the dog jumps on grandma. It's not so cute anymore. Or the dog nibbles on a child's finger who's visiting your house, and that child says, incorrectly, but still says, oh, that dog bit me, I'm terrified, mom, and runs home to mom, you know? Are there behaviors like that that we ought to nip in the bud?
Well, the thing that I always remind people is if your dog is doing something, it's because you gave them access to it, because the only thing dogs can do without our help is sleep, eat, and bark. Right. And breathe. So everything that a dog experiences, we control. So going to kids, if you're going to have your dog around kids, you know, you're going to want to be there to make sure that everything goes according to plan. Right. Which is to make sure everybody has a good time. Nobody is scared or stressed, including the dog. As far as elderly people, you know, again, same thing. Like if you think your dog may jump, then you should have them behind a gate or maybe have them out in the yard if you have a fenced yard, and then have the elderly people enter. As far as puppies, I start teaching them right away an auto sit. with a hand signal. Immediately, I start teaching them. The first time I meet a puppy, I'm teaching them a hand signal for sit, or I'm teaching them to target my hand with their nose for a touch, because that's going to redirect jumping. As far as mouthing goes, it's okay for your puppy to investigate your hand and your body and so forth with their mouth, as long as it's not in a way that's really hard. If they're biting you hard, and they're mouthing you hard, then yeah, you want to time them out. And you might also want to get better with your hands. I mean, one of the things I often remind my clients is, you know, you've got to improve your mechanics. You got to get your hands out of the way. You've got to get your leave it and then your sit, so the puppy is redirected. Dogs are great at learning flow charts as long as humans are consistent with the flow charts. The big problem is, hey, no, cut it out, dog name, stop it, cut it out. And the dog's not getting any really good feedback or instruction. So once the humans get it in their head that they have to teach the dog the proper sequences, things will go much better. So I think that right from the start, you should start teaching your dog all the things that you need to teach them. A good sit stay, good wait at doors and gates, touch hand targeting, emergency recall, name recognition, leave it. You know, if you have the wherewithal to do that, you're going to have a lot more success. Unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of people who kind of wait to train their dog until they're 7 months. And I'm like, well, you missed the critical development period. And mm-hmm. It's called the critical development period for a reason, because they're learning at a rapid rate. So, you know, provided that the puppy's healthy and there's nothing going on with the puppy cognitively, you can start training dogs right away.
And probably should. The name of the book, again, is The Puppy Parents Handbook, Raising a Well-Trained Puppy in the 21st Century. Drayton Michaels is the author of the book. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. So, Drayton, dog bites nationally are up. We can talk about why that's the case. That's a different conversation that I want to have right now. But there are repercussions to dog bites being up. One is insurance rates will go up, even for people who don't have a dog, you know, homeowners insurance, because everything goes up across the board. So when there's a hurricane in Florida, that's devastating to Florida. We pay more in Illinois for our insurance as a result, believe it or not, because insurance companies, and they share the wealth with other insurance companies, meaning that they all go up in rate, even an insurer that isn't even in Florida in the first place. And the same sort of thing happens with dog bites regarding insurance. But it's not only that. It is the dogs that presumably bite more often are the dogs there are more of. And according to the American Kennel Club, the French Bulldog is the most popular dog in America. But for a variety of reasons, including the fact that most dogs these days are adopted from animal shelters, the most popular dog, I'd argue, is a dog you'd look at, or I would look at, with big broad shoulders, a big head, can vary in size anywhere from 25 or 30 pounds to about 100 pounds, muscular-looking dog that we call a pit bull. But what we know from genetic testing is that these dogs oftentimes have no pit bull in them, real pit bull terrier, no Staffordshire bull terrier, no pit bull variety of any kind in that individual dog. A dog looks a certain way, but it doesn't mean the genetics reflect that. That's the thing about dogs. So we're looking at the possibility of pit bull type dogs being blamed, rightly or wrongly, more often, and therefore breed bans coming back. And there's been a talk of that. You've been very involved for many years about fighting breed bans. Are you concerned about the fact that different communities are looking at this all over again?
I'm definitely concerned, and I'm glad you brought up the terrier point, because if there's no terrier in it and there's no bulldog in it, it's probably not a pit bull terrier. Look, there's a criteria to lethal and fatal dog bites. This was derived from 150 years of dog bite research by Karen DeLees in her book, The Pit Bull Placebo. And here's the criteria for lethal and fatal dog bites. Dogs that are kept for nefarious purposes. They're not a family dog. They're there for guarding, breeding, protecting. There's something other going on than just this is our family dog. Number two, kids and dogs left unattended. The biggest group of people who are lethally and fatally bitten by dogs are young kids and elderly. The next criteria is domestic violence. A lot of times when these stories are on the news, you know, the media just rips and reads, and it's real sexy to say, oh, dog attack, pit bull. But when you go deeper into the story, you find out that there was drugs in the home, violence in the home, and it wasn't a really good environment for anybody, let alone a dog. Next criteria is dogs running loose. Next criteria is dogs chained and housed constantly. When dogs are not socialized properly, they develop fear and stress, and those are the underlying cause for aggression. Next criteria, multiple dogs. Okay, so you always have to look at the human component. Now, there's going to be people who want to blame a dog. Dogs have the cognition of three-year-old kids for life by the time they're two, right? They don't have a moral imperative. Fight, flight, freeze, safe, unsafe, neutral. That's how dogs view the world. And unfortunately, people get dogs who are big and strong, and they don't socialize them. They may treat them harshly, and next thing you know, someone's going to get bitten or mauled, and it's usually going to be a small child or an elderly person. And that's the criteria. And people can have all kinds of feelings about it, and they can have all kinds of political motivations towards it. But ultimately, if something happens with a dog, the people who are connected to that dog are to blame.
And all of what you just said, by the way, has been studied and confirmed the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and a variety of other organizations are on board with everything you just said, because we know that to be true. And there's one other thing we know to be true, is that now we can look at communities that have banned specific breeds. They do that because something happens in the community. A public official says, here's the answer. Let's get rid of all the sometimes Rottweilers, Dobermans, whatever breeds, and almost always the dog that looks like, and as I described, isn't at all necessarily, but looks like what we would call a pit bull. It turns out communities that have done that, their motivation is so dog bites go down, so things are safer. Turns out dog bites don't go down after they do that. Communities aren't necessarily safer. It's the same. The problem is everything you just said, addressing those issues rather than the presumed breed, which is often wrong in the first place, that is involved. Can you comment on that?
It's way easier to educate a community than to legislate a community. I've mentioned this before in other interviews. If every, you know, Humane Society or ASPCA, whatever the organization is in that area, if they put together one sheet of paper printed on both sides, how to have a well-socialized dog, how to avoid fear and aggression, using positive reward-based humane dog training, right? Leash laws, all these things that we know keep dogs sane and keep communities safe, they could easily send that out. It could be an email. It could be a hard copy, whatever it is. They have all the registered dogs in that community. Send people every year. Here's how you keep your dog safe. Here's how you keep your community safe. Yeah, it might wind up on the table and don't read it, but at least you're going to have an educational effort that has the community more aware of what to do. That's the thing. You're not going to stop dogs from biting because you ban them. Okay, so you can't have a certain kind of dog in this area. Those people who want a big dog are going to go find a big dog somewhere. Those people who want a little dog, they're going to go find a little dog somewhere. At the end of the day, humans have a bigger brain. We have more intelligence. So we need to be the ones who are responsible for making our community safe. And, you know, as you said, we have tons of research at this point. Breed-specific legislation is not a new phenomenon, and it's been studied ad nauseum. And dog bites don't decrease if you ban certain breeds of dog. My personal reason or my personal feeling why I think dog bites are on the up and fatalities are increasing is because we have more information that's not good information, right? We have more bad information and it's more easily obtained through the internet. And we have more dogs and we have more people. So if you have more dogs, more people, and more bad information, you're going to have an increase in dog bites.
Yeah, I think everything you said is true, except I do disagree about one thing, and that is, I don't know. So politicians often respond with a knee-jerk response, and it seems to be the right thing. So a reported dog attack occurs. It was reported that a pit bull type dog did it, even though there's no pit bull in that dog. That's all beside the point because no one looks at that so much. So a dog that looks a certain way, they're profiling. A dog that looks a certain way is responsible. Let's get rid of all the dogs that look that way. That'll solve a problem. And it sometimes is difficult to convince a community. Now, hopefully we are more educated than we were when the breed bans were all the most popular thing to do. But I'm not so sure of that. And with dog bites being up, and I do agree that that's one of the reasons why dog bites are up, which is a whole other conversation to have. I sure hope these breed bans don't happen like they did, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. They've shown not to do anything except cost communities money. And when you talk to public officials about that, then they pay attention. The name of the person I am talking to is Drayton Michaels. We are talking about his latest book, The Puppy Parents Handbook, Raising a Well-Trained Puppy, No Matter What Breed That Puppy Is. I added that part. In the 21st Century. Drayton, a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, I really appreciate it, Steve, and I want to just thank you for all you do. You're a great champion of positive dog training and dogs and pets everywhere, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Legendary agriculture broadcaster Max Armstrong has written a book called More Stories from the Heartland. And Max, I remember doing this radio show, because we've been doing this show for 20 years, years ago, it wasn't 20 years ago, but it was years ago, and took a phone call from someone who commented about how I don't understand dogs or cats, that they are for working purposes only. Cats to hunt, you know, barn cats, and dogs to work on farms. He was a farmer and didn't quite understand how dogs and cats share our beds with us. I think that's changed among people who happen to live in rural America. What do you think?
Well, it's a highly individual thing, to be sure, Steve. But yes, indeed, many people who live on the farm have their companion animals, and they love them dearly. Now, that doesn't mean that those animals aren't also working in many instances. But a friend of mine, a perfect example, a friend of mine on a farm in Colorado posted just the other day that she had lost her dog. And you could tell she was so distraught. I mean, it had passed away, and it had been such a wonderful companion for her over the years, of course. And I think many of us feel such a strong bond, even if our animals are doing some work on the farm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. However, the fact remains that pets are members of the family. And I would argue that that part of it, there's less and less distinction between rural America and urban America. What do you think?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I don't think there's any difference at all in that regard. These are members of the family to us, and they perform so superbly. Sometimes they're helping open the gates. They may be helping move the cattle out there, but they obey, and they hop in the truck, and they go everywhere with us in many instances. And yes, they are truly, I would say, companion animals. So they may work, but they are companion animals.
So the book is called More Stories from the Heartland. Give me in 2 minutes a dog story or a cat story, of which you have several. I know that you and I would communicate back and forth about one of your dogs named Toby.
Yeah, Toby was our Jack Russell when we lived in the Chicago area, and he passed away. And as we had buried him near the home, and as we were getting ready to leave the area, a couple of neighbor ladies showed up at the front door one night, and they said, "Well, you're not going to leave Toby here, are you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "He was such a wonderful family member, and you can't just leave him with strangers coming in." My wife knew what was coming. She warned me. She said, "You better go to the door for this one." So sure enough, we didn't exactly exhume Toby, but we did. We had wrapped him well. We had wrapped him in plastic when we buried him, and he made the trip 5 states away, and I buried Toby a second time. He's on a knoll now, overlooking this little teeny tiny horse farmette.
Well, the good news is you cared enough to do that. I guess the bad news is you had to travel with that in the car for a day and a half.
No. He was in a shipping container, Steve.
Okay.
I must tell you, I was tracking that container that summer. That container went through 90-degree temperatures in Atlanta, and I thought, oh, boy. But nope. Toby was just fine when we unpacked the container here at his new home. And I'm looking right now at the knoll out the window there. Oh, it's probably about 3 football fields from me where Toby lies in state.
I hope people pay their respects periodically. The name of the book is More Stories Just Like That, or Not, from the Heartland legendary agriculture broadcaster Max Armstrong. It is always a pleasure to speak with you. Where can people get the book?
Yeah, MaxArmstrongBook.com is a place where they can go, Steve. They can get the physical book. There is a digital version also that folks can download, and there is an audio book. I can keep you company in the car for 3.5 hours or so and try to stay awake for that.
If you want this man to drive with you for 3.5 hours or so, check it out. Give me that website once again, Max.
MaxArmstrongBook.com, Steve.
MaxArmstrongBook.com. Max Armstrong, thank you so much. Sometimes I get email, which I try to answer. So this one is, why does my dog stare at me so often? Well, there are lots of possibilities for that, a combination of reasons, perhaps. Love is one of them. I mean, our dogs really sometimes, really most of the time, really do love us. And just like we may stare at our significant other, you know, we're smitten, right? We love them. And dogs can do the same. Sometimes it's like they want to look deep into your soul. And we don't know exactly what they are getting more out of that than we might suggest. And we don't even understand, but they're sensing a whole lot about our emotions. Sometimes they stare at us to get our attention. A dog that needs to go out, a dog that wants to do something like get fed, that dog might stare at you. Sometimes dogs that are stressed out will stare, and sometimes dogs will stare as a precursor to aggression. Bright and early next week, as always, on WGN.